From KCUR News, this is Casey Currens reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. On this week's show, how the potential outcomes of the fiscal cliff could impact our region.
It'll be like a lost year. People will feel it as a lost year. We were growing and now we're not again.
Plus, an area business reminds us of a time when toys were a little simpler.
We can't resist stopping for toys and marbles and marble mazes, and I knew we would enjoy it.
And how a holiday event founded by a Missouri native is becoming a growing national tuba tradition.
The challenge of putting this together is in part logistical because you have hundreds of performers. And the other part is the fact that there are players of all different levels, from amateurs to professionals, graduate students, everything you can imagine.
Listen up for Casey Currens just after this hour's news. This is Casey Currens. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currens is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. The Kansas City region has been recovering from the recession at a slightly faster clip than many other places across the country, with unemployment and personal income exceeding the national average by about 0.5%.
But if Congress and the White House don't come to an agreement before the end of the year, our relative progress will go south quickly. That's the conclusion of a report from the Mid-America Regional Council. It examined how our region would be affected should Congress and the White House fail to come to an agreement and the fiscal cliff, spending cuts, and tax increases go into effect. The author of the MARC report, Senior Director of Research Frank Lenk, told KCUR's Laura Ziegler the service economy would be by far the hardest hit.
Food and drinking, health, administrative support jobs, and then professional technical. Those are the fastest growers, also the largest. And health never really went down during the recession, and it wouldn't decline, but it would grow by a few thousand jobs less. But administrative and support jobs would be the sector of services hit the most. There's a lot of temporary work in that one, and those jobs just wouldn't get created.
You know, that's counterintuitive to me, because in a time when unemployment is increasing, that suggests that employers aren't investing in permanent employees and they'd be hiring more temp workers.
But the economy is recovering now, and so they're hiring temp workers now because they don't want to hire full-time employees. And so if it starts if we have a recession, then what happens is they cut back on all their hiring plans. So there's a good chunk of them were going to be temporary workers anyway. Those are the easiest ones not to hire.
So the service sector may be hit the hardest, but your data also suggests that all sectors of the economy will be hit: retail, manufacturing, IT, finance, real estate. Will we be able to see what's happening? Will we be able to tell that this is going on?
Well, I think so. Number one, everyone will feel it in their paychecks. If you're going to get a 2% raise, which would be maybe about average, you won't see any raise. Everyone feels it that way. And then the scope of government programs that would be cut under sequestration is really, quite broad. I've heard everything from education to emergency assistance to Department of Justice and Health and Human Services and housing. And there's lots of ways that people might feel the impact. Construction would be one I would expect would take a hit. You'll see construction stop again. If you're just looking around at the economy, will you notice that things are slower? I think you'll see that people are not going out to eat as much. The general mood and optimism will have shrunk. You'll get reports that more people are out of work, and that will have a negative impact on hiring, on investment, and overall confidence. So people will see it that way. Will they themselves get laid off? What we show is not so much that a lot of people losing their jobs, but there is no hiring. And so we end the year just slightly below where we left off. The region would lose about 2,000 jobs over the year of 2013. And so it'll be like a lost year. People will feel it as a lost year. We were growing and now we're not again.
Yeah, and growing really relatively robustly.
Relatively well. It'll feel like a recession all over again. It'll be like a relapse, like you were sick and you had a relapse. And instead of getting better, you start to get worse again.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong, if I'm not understanding this correctly, but if there is any good news in this, we may see a recovery sooner than we did previously.
Yeah, so rather than having I think the recession started in December of 2007 and went through June of 2009, so pretty much an 18-month recession. This will be a two-quarter recession, very short, pretty steep. You know, taxes will go up and spending will go down, and you'll see, you know, it'll be more like hitting the brakes going after accelerating to a highway speed. So you'll get a sharp slowdown, but it doesn't last very long, and then the economy will begin to pick back up again. The real loss is you lose a year of recovery, and so rather than having, like I said, gained 22,000, you'll have lost 2,000 jobs. And then the economy, when it does pick up again and start to grow again, it grows slower. It'll take longer for it to get back up to growing at the same rate that it was before. But the economy is in a more resilient spot, so it wouldn't be as disastrous.
Than it was in 2008.
It was in 2008.
Yeah.
But it still wouldn't be a good thing. And you can see some signs that businesses are holding back. And the longer they do that, you know, the harder it becomes to grow again. And there's a psychology to getting things to grow. We finally have gotten to the point where it's beginning to work in our favor. And if we interrupt that, it'll take us a while to get back to that same growth psychology again.
Frank Lenk is the Senior Director of Research Services at Mid-America Regional Council. Thanks very much, Frank. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
That was KCUR's Laura Ziegler talking to Frank Lenk of the Mid-America Regional Council. Check KCUR's website, kcur.org, for the latest on the fiscal cliff negotiations from NPR.
Since the U.S. Department of Agriculture launched its federal organic certification program in 2002, the number of organic farms have more than doubled. And to help ensure that consumers get what they pay extra for, the USDA next month will enforce closer oversight of these farms. But as Harvest Public Media's Abby Fentress Swanson reports from Columbia, Missouri, small family farms are questioning the cost and time that go into securing that USDA organic label.
I'm standing in one of the fastest growing departments of this Schnucks supermarket, the organic produce section. It may seem like there's not much going on in this fluorescent lit chili space, but Dave Guthrie has seen big changes in 17 years as produce manager.
When I first started working in produce, for example, you could only get one or two varieties of organic apples, like a red or gold delicious. Now we have six varieties of organic apples, and strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, blackberries. Before, you could just get strawberries.
Across the U.S., more than 17,000 farms produce organic food on 5 million acres. Most of them are small family farms, but you might be surprised to know food giants like Kraft and Kellogg own organic companies and actually dominate the market. Big operations have no problem paying for the extra record keeping and inspections that go along with organic certification. But for small operations like Chert Hollow Farm, is the organic label worth it?
All right, we're going to go take these into them, and I'll pick the rest of this bed for the pigs.
Chert Hollow Farm is just north of Columbia, Missouri. In a baseball cap and flannel shirt, the farm's owner, Eric Reuter, feeds organic lettuce to his goats and hogs. For the past 4 years, this lettuce and all the produce grown here has been certified organic. Not one pesticide or chemical gets used on these fields, and anything he and his wife, Joanna, do to the land is documented.
Annually, we submit a ream of paperwork that documents both our organic systems plan, meaning all the methods and skills and knowledge we use to run this farm organically, as well as records that track our produce from seed to sale for every type of produce we grow. That's about 150 varieties that we grow.
Since they're a diversified farm, Chert Hollow's certification application is more extensive than other farms producing just one product. They also pay an organic certifier roughly $700 annually. Most of that is subsidized by a cost-share program in the Farm Bill, but it's still a chunk of change up front for small farms. And should Farm Bill funding not be renewed, the Reuters will ask customers who buy food from them through their Community Supported Agriculture Program, or CSA, if they want to pay for the organic certification.
We actually did a survey of our CSA members this year, and a far higher percentage of them said that they valued our organic methods than valued our organic certification. And so, you know, you have to think about, are you getting your money's worth and your time's worth from using the O word versus just marketing yourself as a sustainable farm?
60 miles southeast of Chert Hollow sits a small bucolic livestock operation called JJR Family Farm. John Rice owns it with his wife, Julie. But while driving his truck to load some hay, the wiry, mustachioed farmer says JJR dropped the certification this summer because they just couldn't sell enough.
I was producing more than I could sell. And the same with hogs and chickens. I didn't have any. Well, sometimes I got hung on eggs. I'd have to sell to come down on the price on eggs. Well, I got to load some hay.
Rice had to drive to Kansas and Iowa to buy organic grain to feed his livestock because there was no place to buy it in Missouri. The closest organic certified slaughtering house was 600 miles away in Illinois. Add to that the cost of organic feed, which was twice the cost of conventional grain, and organic processing and labeling, which also cost more than $500 more per cow.
And I was pricing most of my stuff at around $8, $9 a pound at these grain prices because of my transportation costs. And then when these grain prices shoot up to that, then my wife and I said, there's no sense even going up. These people roll their eyeballs now. There's no sense continuing on with it.
But independent farm inspector Sue Baird still believes producing organic food can make small farms extra profit, sometimes the extra profit they need to stay in business. Of course, she is inspecting those farms.
Can I say this? Anytime there's opportunity to make money, there are people who would push the limit all the way. It's grown from a culture of people who just believed in organic to a big business.
After all, consumers won't continue to pay extra for organic food if they don't believe that the products are really pesticide, antibiotic, and GMO-free.
Consumers really want to know what they're paying for. And if they're paying for organic and paying a premium price for organic, then they want to be assured that they're receiving the value for the product they're paying for.
The new regulations coming into effect next year will make pesticide testing uniform among certifiers. They'll also require random pesticide residue tests at 5% of organic farms each year. Farms found violating the rules can be fined up to $11,000 per violation and lose that organic label. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Abby Fentress-Swanson. Remember Moonies, Shooters, and Cat Eyes? We're talking marbles just ahead. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents, and I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. It's the year the ancient Mayans are said to have predicted the end of the world. Not so, say scholars of the Mayan civilization. The Mayans lived and live today in Mexico and Central America. Mayan scholar John Hoops is an associate professor of archaeology at the University of Kansas. Hoops is an expert in pre-Columbian civilizations and has helped debunk the 2012 myth, but along the way he's become fascinated with it and has gone from studying the myths of ancient Latin America to the myths of the modern-day United States. KCUR's Sylvia Maria Gross caught up with Professor Hoops earlier this year.
How did you first get interested in pre-Columbian civilizations?
I was a very avid fantasy and science fiction fan when I was in elementary school and junior high. Fantasy led me into science fiction, and then it was reading that stuff that led me into things like Chariots of the Gods and Carlos Castaneda and a lot of the other speculative literature of the early 70s.
That's interesting, because that's some of where some of the stories about the Maya that are not so factual may be spun out.
Well, that's exactly right. I think the Maya have always fascinated those people who were interested in science and interested in discovery, but also who had very vivid imaginations that they exercised quite freely.
Maybe we can take a step back and you can tell us a little bit about the Mayan civilization.
Well, it's a fascinating culture that has roots that go back well over 3,000 years. It's a complex story that begins with the very origins of social complexity in Mexico, a part of the world that we call Mesoamerica, and comes all the way up to the present day. In fact, there are 6 million living Maya alive today, and I think it's fair to say that Maya civilization is thriving.
And the Maya are known for having been very advanced mathematicians and astronomers for the age in which they lived.
That's true, but I don't think that they were any more obsessed with math and the stars than were, for example, the ancient Greeks, who had a very highly advanced astronomy and astrology as well.
So is that part of the myth that we've sort of come to associate Maya with being particularly connected to math and the stars?
Well, the sad story is that I think it's an example of cognitive dissonance. No one is surprised that the ancient Greeks, who were basically white people of the Mediterranean, were technologically advanced. It's a different story when people are asked to accept that people who didn't look like them, who had darker skin and who came from the Americas and were an indigenous people, actually had mathematics and astronomy and philosophy. So, ironically, I think racism plays a part in why people seem to be surprised that the indigenous peoples of Mexico were so, quote-unquote, advanced when they don't feel the same way about the Greeks.
The 2012 idea comes from the calendar. So I wonder if you can just explain how the Mayan calendar works.
Well, the Mayan calendar, unlike our calendar, is mostly based on a count of days as opposed to a count of years. And so the concept of year 2012 is really one that doesn't work in the Maya calendar very well. The Mayas were focused specifically on large cycles of time, increasingly larger cycles of time. The smallest unit was a day, which was called a quin. They also thought in terms of cycles of 20 days, of 360 days, of 7,200 days, of 144,000 days, and then we get into the sort of controversial area as to whether there were even larger cycles of 13 of those 144,000-day cycles to make up a big cycle, what was known as a great cycle, that would have had 1,872,000 days. But they kept track of these counts of days with these different units.
And that great cycle would be how many years?
That great cycle would be a little bit less than 5,126 years.
And that's the cycle that supposedly would end on December 21st, 2012.
That's correct. Either that or December 23rd. And I think it's fair to say that scholars are still disagreeing as to which correlation is correct, whether it would be the 21st or the 23rd.
And how did people come to believe that that meant that the Mayan believed that the world would end on that day, the end of, I guess, one of the great cycles?
Well, that's a really interesting question because it's something that doesn't come up really until the mid-20th century when you get a combination of the thinking pertaining to a document called the Dresden Codex, which is an ancient Maya book, and the interpretations of the Maya calendar. And long before there was any speculation about the date 2012 itself, although the calendar had actually been worked out, a scholar named Ernst Firstmann, a German scholar, had come to the conclusion that the Dresden Codex, on its very last page, had a depiction of a flood that represented the destruction of the world. But he never wrote about 2012. It wasn't until that interpretation becomes combined with Joseph Goodman's theory that there were these 13 Bakhtun cycles, the 5,125-point-something-day cycles, that the two kind of come together into this myth.
Is it the 13th one that's supposed to then end on that day, and they associated with those images of the Armageddon?
Well, it's not so much images of Armageddon. The images in the Dresden Codex show what's basically a giant snake with water pouring out of its mouth. What happens is that when Michael Coe combines these two concepts in his book, The Maya, which is published in 1966, he becomes the first person to link the notion of the end of the 13th Bakhtun with the concept of Armageddon.
And now, what do many academics think?
I don't think there are any academics who feel that the Maya indicated in any way that the end of the 13th Bakhtun would represent destruction. I think that sort of got hooked into the mythology, and there's very little support for it at all. In fact, there's really only one monument that refers to what will happen on that day, and it doesn't say anything about destruction at all.
And some believe that actually was a Western idea.
Well, that's right. That's part of my own thinking as well, is that there was a tremendous preoccupation with the end of the world right at the time that the civilizations of the Americas were being discovered. In fact, Christopher Columbus, of all people, was compiling something that he called the Libro de las Profecías, or the Book of Prophecies, around 1500, 1502, during his fourth voyage to the New World, which was when he actually first came in contact with people who were themselves in contact with the Mayas. And in his Libro de Profecías, he compiled references that came from ancient literature and from the Bible in support of what he felt was a prediction that the discovery of these most distant lands would bring about the sequence of events that were described in the Book of Revelation, and that his discovery of the New World would actually bring about the Second Coming and the events that were described at the end of the Bible. In the early years of contact, it became melded together into an eschatological syncretism in which Western ideas about the end of the world were overlaid on what were said to have been indigenous ideas.
As an archaeologist yourself, I would think that you might be highly annoyed at the propagation of this idea.
Well, annoyed, I'm annoyed at it the same way I'm annoyed by ancient aliens, in that it propagates what I see as a contemporary mythology about the ancient past, which ignores scholarship. It ignores the enormous hard work of scholars and graduate students and people who write dissertations and people who do archaeological field work and people who work very hard on academic books and attempting to figure all of this out in favor of what's essentially a very simplistic explanation that really doesn't explain very much at all.
But at the same time, it seems like you've also become interested in how, as a mythology, this 2012 phenomenon has come about.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's because I'm very interested in sort of the use of narratives about the past in the present, which I see as being something that's common to all religions, which tend to start with creation stories. And I see it as a really interesting phenomenon in contemporary society that may very well result in the creation of some new religious traditions. One of the phrases I like to use is the invention of sacred tradition, which comes from religious studies scholars James Lewis and Olaf Hammer, who put together a book with that title. But the invention of sacred tradition refers to this process of sort of creating mythologies to explain the past for the purpose of communicating a contemporary ethical and moral position.
And what is the 2012 story that you most frequently hear now?
The one that is most frequently propagated, actually there are two varieties. The one that I see most frequently is this end-of-the-world notion, which can be traced to, what's the best way to describe it, a lot of very avid commercialism on the part of book publishers and cable stations and programs like the History Channel, very much like the way they're promoting Ancient Aliens. It's something that enters into popular culture. Of course, Roland Emmerich's movie 2012 is the clearest expression of that. But I see that as far less interesting, to be perfectly honest, than the idea that 2012 might bring about a sort of new age transformation of consciousness, a new way of thinking about the world, a revolution in human thought and spirituality, which itself is kind of intriguing. I see it as being based in some of these other elements of contemporary mythology. But it is something that I think has much more juice in it as a philosophical issue.
Yeah, and that's where it's sort of related maybe to some of the other issues that we face today of the environment and war, maybe nuclear proliferation, all of that.
Well, that's exactly right. And ironically, interestingly, I think that Coe's use of the term Armageddon was one that he selected because back in the 60s, because of the Cold War, there was a lot of discussion about Armageddon. But back then, it was nuclear Armageddon. But the type of apocalyptic experiences that people are discussing now have much more to do with the environment and with global warming and with social revolutions and with a variety of things that are happening around the world, economically, politically, which, quite frankly, have always been happening in one way or another. But we're much more aware and cognizant of them now because of digital networks and new modes of communication.
This is Casey Currents. We're speaking with John Hoops of KU's Department of Anthropology about the 2012 phenomenon. Now, how did this idea end up spreading?
It actually has roots that go back to the 19th century in the work of people like Helena Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society in the 1870s, 1880s. But then they also resonate in the beat culture of the 1950s. In fact, William S. Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg both had intense interests in the Maya. Burroughs went to Mexico in order to study ancient Maya writing, and Allen Ginsberg spent several months at Palenque in Chiapas, where he wrote poetry and actually did some archaeological exploration. So interest in the Maya enters the consciousness of a subculture through the beats. It then becomes very popular in the context of what became the ancestral grounds of Silicon Valley in the 1960s, in the context of counterculture at UC Berkeley and Stanford.
And these were people who are involved in the experimentation with psychedelic drugs and was part of sort of the hippie movement too, right?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, it was the beats who sort of their hipness gave way to the hippies. And it was in the context of Northern California that people like Ken Kesey used LSD in the context of government-sponsored experiments. And this powerful psychedelic was also given to academics and scientists at Stanford University and at Berkeley. And interestingly, it was some of those same scientists who became early computer programmers.
Now, just taking a step back, what do you get from reviewing the origins of the 2012 myth? I wonder, what are you learning about us?
Well, what I'm seeing is an alternative history of the United States in one respect. I haven't seen as many histories of the counterculture as I would like to see. And I think that there are a lot of things that have influenced our music, our films, our books, our popular culture, that have deep roots in American history that go all the way back to the spiritual exploration of the founding fathers.
And what part, sort of more specifically, do you mean?
Well, for one, the tremendous variety of American religious experience, in particular the esoteric and the occult dimensions, which are out of the mainstream, but that nonetheless represent a very strong current in art and in philosophy and in music.
And they went on to influence the countercultural movements of the 60s.
Yes, that's right. Many of them had important influences on what's now known as the New Age movement, which is really an alternative spirituality. I think a phrase that's fairly common these days is to hear from people that they are spiritual but not religious. And when you look into what that means, often it will mean that they embrace alternative values that may come from Eastern religions, such as Buddhism or Hinduism, or they may come from Native American traditions, or they may come from other areas. Well, those ideas were introduced to American culture by this milieu of the late 19th century.
And where do you see this sort of new form of spirituality heading?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think a lot of it has to do with digital technology, and a lot of it has to do with the speed and rapidity with which we know things and think about them. And actually, waxing philosophical, I think that a better term than a transformation of consciousness would be a transformation of conscience. And what I mean by a transformation of conscience is how we think morally and ethically about the things that are happening in the world, which we now have far more access to than we ever did before.
KCOR's Sylvia Maria Gross spoke with KU archaeology professor John Hoops earlier this year.
If you missed part of Casey Currents today, you can catch individual stories or hear the whole show online at kcur.org. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
As the winter holidays approach, toys are on the mind of children and parents alike. So this week, we take you to a unique place, the Moon Marble Company in Bonner Springs, Kansas, where toys and, of course, marbles draw crowds from all over. Susan dropped by to check it out.
As a kid, I loved marbles and collected them. I was fascinated by the twists of vibrant color inside of the small glass globes. So imagine my delight when I discovered the Moon Marble Company. Moon Marble Company is housed in a gray, low-slung building wedged almost smack against the railroad tracks at the fork of K-32 and Highway 7 in Bonner Springs. A chalkboard sign welcomes visitors with the message, "Welcome to the Moon."
A lot of people, as soon as they walk in the door, they kind of go, "Wow," you know, because we have this whole wall of marbles.
The wall is made up of bins of marbles that have inspired names like Tidal Wave, Fiesta, and Tree Frog because of their vibrant colors. But marbles are not the only attraction here. There are wooden game boards and wind-up toys from the 50s and 60s, reminders of a time when play was, well, simpler.
Airplanes.
I love airplanes.
We have real jacks, real pickup sticks, and of course real marbles. We don't deal in plastic marbles. We don't say that word, plastic.
Marbles are by far the most popular toy here, and marble lovers from around the country come here to find marbles that meet their particular fancy.
We can't resist stopping for toys and marbles and marble mazes, and I knew we would enjoy it.
Now, do either of you play traditional marbles?
Not anymore, but I used to all the time. I mean, when I was much younger, and my mother ran a daycare, and we used to play marbles there. We did the shooters and the whole thing, yeah.
The shooters, also known as the boss or taw, are larger-sized marbles used for, well, shooting other marbles. Now, this isn't just a place for toys and machine-produced marbles. It's also a place where marbles are made.
My name is Bruce Breslow, and I'm the owner and glass worker at the Moon Marble Company.
He has curly salt-and-pepper hair, a bushy beard, and eyes that twinkle. Today, Bruce is giving a marble-making demonstration to a group of visitors.
The first layer is called the transmitted layer color, but when you view it...
He shapes the colored, iridescent, molten glass with a round marble-making tool.
But now I'm really going to twist it. I'm not
passing the marble in and out of the orange flame, the handcrafted marble takes its form.
I'm going to get a lot of heat on them. All right, that's good.
The Moon Marble Company used to be Bruce's wood shop. He started as a cabinet maker and did a lot of custom woodworking. All this work left a pile of scrap he couldn't bear to waste.
So I started gluing them up and making game boards out of them. I thought, I'm just going to make some toys and games. And I made these game boards and needed marbles for the game board.
So he went to a local store to get some marbles, but he was disappointed by their boring selection. Marbles of only one size, one color, all the same. What he wanted were the colorful marbles from his childhood. The ones like Moonies, which are bluish-white, translucent, and look like the moon, or Cat Eyes with an eye-shaped colored core. So back in 1997, before he started making his own, he decided to open Moon Marble Company. To get started, he found a supplier that had the coveted marbles from his past.
I said, just send me a case of every color you have and every size. And several weeks later, the semi-truck backed up to our back dock door. I bought 85,000 marbles.
The word spread quickly about the guy with all the marbles. Next thing he knew,
people started coming here.
Realizing that people shared his excitement for marbles, he decided to take up marble making himself. He read everything he could about it, piecing together information from books, from other glass artisans, and then he started experimenting.
If you came in years ago, I was making like a marble out of a little Coke bottle. I'd break up some glass from a Coke bottle and turn it into a marble. But you could see after today, we've gone a little further in that.
Further in that now, Bruce is making marbles that look like a cosmic vortex, flowers trapped in time, and the shell of a turtle. Bruce's handmade marbles seem to be more than just a child's plaything. They're his art. Visitors Jeff Malner and Kathy Barron.
It's amazing how he can put as much color and how the light hits it, and they're just beautiful.
The glass, the art to it, the designs inside,
they're kind of thrilling that way.
Moon Marble Company has grown into a successful business for Bruce. He can now make a living from his passion, working as a full-time marble and toy man.
I learn every day, so I'll spend my whole life and never be able to use all the colors and learn all the techniques and processes.
But he'll keep trying. Bruce Breslow says that our children have lost something important by not spending as much time on the playground. So he's doing his part, one marble at a time, to get that special something back. For Casey Currents, I'm Susan Wilson.
You can see pictures from Moon Marble Company on our website at kcur/caseycurrents.org. Coming up, holiday sounds from over 300 tuba players. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. In area news this week, some public employees were charged with a $300,000 wellness incentive scam. Kansas libertarians were up in arms about open carry bans. And after many false starts, a Kansas City streetcar project got rolling. KCUR's Steve Bell looked back on those and other top stories of the week on KCUR's Weekend News Review.
Only residents of the streetcar district could vote in the streetcar tax election. Only 549 of them did. Mayor Sly James made the announcement.
We are going to have a streetcar in Kansas City by June of 2015.
The 1 cent sales tax hike and 5% property tax increase passed by almost a 2-to-1 margin. Councilman Russ Johnson, the project point man, talked about the winning strategy for the election.
The plan was, how can we get this thing down to some low-hanging fruit that get this thing started? Instead of trying to eat the whole elephant at once, where do we start one bite at a time? And so this is the first bite.
The day after election results were announced, the council chose a firm to finish the planning process, appropriated $3.6 million to pay for that, and approved issuing $30 million in bonds to finance construction of the 2-mile streetcar line. Kansas City, Kansas, Lenexa, Prairie Village, and Leawood found themselves threatened with a lawsuit over ordinances that prohibit the open carry of firearms. Tim McIntosh of the Libertarian Party of Kansas told TV9,
"All we are asking is for city and municipalities and county to follow state law."
The Kansas law forbidding bans on open carry of firearms was passed 5 years ago. Federal prosecutors charged 6 Kansas City, Missouri public employees and 1 Jackson County corrections worker with scamming Blue Cross and Blue Shield out of more than $300,000 worth of wellness incentives for healthy living. Prosecutors say they did things like claiming a 1-year-old ran in a marathon. The feds also charged a man who worked in the St. Joseph license fee office with providing fake ID for 100 or more illegal immigrants.
Basically, the illegal aliens would pay a greater price in the sense that they were normally charged anywhere from $500 to $950 for a document set.
U.S. Attorney David Ketchmark, who said a similar but not identical case involving different employees of the St. Joseph Fee Office is pending. The Missouri Hospital Association pleaded for a Medicaid expansion, reporting that member hospitals got stuck with over $1 billion worth of unpaid medical bills last year, and an MU study found that the Medicaid expansion would create 24,000 jobs. But Republican leaders in Jefferson City were not moved. House Speaker Tim Jones' response was,
"I think it's economically reckless. I think it's unsustainable."
Governor Jay Nixon, a Democrat, wants to expand Medicaid to cover another 300,000 Missourians. The Kansas City Royals got sports fans talking with a 6-player trade that netted the Royals pitchers James Shields and Wade Davis. General Manager Dayton Moore said it was a model for the Royals' commitment to a brighter future.
"If we're going to improve and if we want our young players to reach their ceiling, you got to begin to win games at the major league level. And James Shields and Wade Davis put us in a position to do just that."
The Chiefs seemed doomed to a dismal short-range future. A 30-7 loss to Cleveland was a double disappointment for coach Romeo Crennel.
"That was one I would have liked to have won if for no other reason other than the fact that I used to coach there."
Crennel also lamented the broken ribs of the team's leading receiver, Dwayne Bowe, who will likely be out for the rest of the season. This is KCUR.
Finding meaning in contemporary art often depends more on the viewer than the artist. What you make of the work is up to you, but what words would you use? As KCUR's Laura Spencer reports, an exhibition at the Epstein Gallery explores the intersection between art and words and the open-ended nature of language.
Remember palindromes? They're words or phrases that read the same forwards and backwards.
Early on, I realized that I was collecting things that are reversal pairs, like straw and warts, that are palindromatic.
Benaya Lesky describes his multimedia sculptural works as playing kickball with language. And when he and Archie Scott Gober, known for his glossy paintings with well-turned phrases, met as studio neighbors during artist residencies at Studios Inc., they recognized kindred spirits.
We've always had kind of a rapport and have been pursuing the same things in very, very different ways.
We both deal with language. We both deal with conceptual ideas.
At Wit's End is the title of their exhibition at the Epstein Gallery at Village Shalom. It's a white box gallery tucked into a retirement community in Overland Park. Gober says the title is a wink about being witty through wordplay and perhaps the undoing of that.
Most people think that language is this sort of absolute thing, and it's not. Words mean many different things, and when used in different contexts, they change constantly.
Lesky and Gober both graduated from the Kansas City Art Institute a decade apart. And the two artists have a similar approach. They make lists of ideas, and if they stick, it's something they pursue. Gober says when he stretches a canvas, he often doesn't know what the work is going to be until he begins. In his painting Revulsion, the word revolting is centered in the work in capital red letters.
Say you start with the word rebel. And you're thinking about rebellion and rebels and things like that. And then you go, well, revolt. Okay, revolt, revolution. And then you go, well, here's something worth some time, revolting. Just making a painting that says revolting operates on, you know, so many levels. We're revolting. Or that's disgusting.
Exhibition curator James Martin says he was surprised how much the works related to each other visually when they were installed in the gallery.
Scott has a piece that looks to be sort of folding in on itself, placed next to Benaya's envelope pieces, which of course are all about folding. And then on the other wall, we've got two pieces, Scott's God's Eye painting, and Benaya has these conceptual panel pieces based on junk email. The color palette for the works are all very similar.
Martin says the meaning of the works is up to the viewer. And as a viewer, he chooses to look for something positive. But that can also be a challenge.
And I'm basically talking about optimism. So like Benaya has a piece with the words drone strike. So how do you take those two words and come away with something positive from that?
This piece by Benaya Lesky called Work Strike, constructed from cut paper, also has the words bar and tender, enjoy and ride, as well as drone and strike.
You can be struck in a number of different ways. A drone is a genderless insect. A drone can also be a meditative tone.
We're starting our own revolution. It's just heavily camouflaged.
It's an ongoing and open-ended dialogue between the artists and the viewer, both spoken and unspoken. Laura Spencer, KCUR News.
The exhibition At Wit's End runs through January 6th at the Epstein Gallery at Village Shalom in Overland Park, Kansas. More information is in the Arts and Culture section of our website, kcur.org. Christmas was founded by Harvey Phillips, a Missouri native, over 30 years ago. It brings tuba and euphonium players together once a year to play a concert of traditional holiday songs for the season. There are over 200 Tuba Christmas concerts across the U.S. This is the fifth year that the Kansas City Symphony hosted the Tuba Christmas in KC, and as KC Current's intern Zach Lewandowski found out, the concert, featuring the biggest brass instrument, keeps getting bigger and bigger.
At some point or another, you've probably heard the doorbell ring, only to be surprised by Christmas carolers. Well, imagine if you open the door to 300 tuba players playing the jolly songs of Christmas. On Friday afternoon, hundreds of Christmas enthusiasts were treated to a concert at the Kauffman Center for Performing Arts. Frank Byrne, executive director of the Kansas City Symphony, explains how the venue has changed over the years due to increased popularity.
When we did it this year, we were reacting to the enormous success of last year, our first year in the Kauffman Center, where we had over 600 performers here. And it was so many performers that we didn't have room for the families and audience members who wanted to hear the performance. So this year we decided that out of self-preservation, we would need to limit the number of performers to ensure that we left room for the audience.
Limiting performers meant that Byrne would have to split the performance into 2 days so that everyone could play. But it's still the same old traditional Tuba Christmas.
Tuba Christmas is one of about 200-plus events that occur around the nation in the holiday time. And it began in 1974 with a performance at Rockefeller Center. And since that time, it's grown to be all over the country and even around the world.
Tuba Christmas has gotten so big that even record books are interested.
They were tempted to call the Guinness Book of World Records, but then when we discovered that, you know, that we're doing it across 2 days, not one, of course, that changes it. But there's no question that it's one of the largest in the nation.
Owen Evans was one of 300-plus performers in Helzberg Hall. Many of the performers wore Santa hats and decorated their tubas with Christmas garland. I asked Owen if one word could describe a player who plays with such a large instrument with such a powerful sound.
Eccentric might be the best word, and you can tell that by the way these things are decorated. It takes a lot of air, intestinal fortitude, we say, for our band students to play a tuba.
With so many eccentric performers, one might think the sound could become overbearing. But that wasn't the case, according to audience member Rita Heinzelman.
We were in the mezzanine level, and you could hear perfectly. And it wasn't too loud, it wasn't too soft, it was perfect.
The songs may sound great, but that doesn't mean it's easy getting over 300 musicians of all ages to sound as one.
The challenge of putting this together is in part logistical because you have hundreds of performers, and the other part is the fact that there are players of all different levels, from amateurs to professionals, graduate students, everything you can imagine.
The event is getting so popular that people add hundreds of miles to their car's odometer just for the chance to play one day.
Had people come from as far as Sioux Falls, South Dakota, a six-hour drive from Kansas City. And I know that there were people from places like Lincoln, Nebraska, and St. Louis. So there are people from all over the region that choose to come here just for the fun of being part of this. And I think one of the special things about the one hosted here by the Kansas City Symphony is that people get to perform in Helzberg Hall, our home.
Eric Griffin is a teacher at Mission Trail Middle School. He sums up the event by saying that for these musicians, it's a chance to step out of the shadows and into the spotlight.
For student musicians who are learning to play tuba, oftentimes the music we play at a band concert or other performance, the tuba players don't always get the melody. They are often playing the bass line or other background parts, and so an event like this is really cool for them because they get the melody all the time, or at least a good deal of the time.
For KCUR, I'm Zach Lewandowski.
You can see a slideshow from this year's Tuba Christmas concert on our website at kcur.org. We appreciate you tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.